Welcome back to Nubian Tigers Talk podcast, a podcast brought to you by Black Princeton alumni, where we talk about issues that impact our Black communities. So, Ray, welcome back to the second show post-hiatus, and I hope everyone enjoyed our talk about the theater
absolutely
from the last time. But today, we have a very special show. We have two young Black entrepreneurs with us today. And they happen to be family.
That's right. Your niece and my nephew.
Yeah, so we're going to call this the family hour. Mm-hmm. And on our show today, we have Alicia Scott, who's my niece, as you said. So Alicia's first love was fashion design, and she started her career in the fashion industry. While she was observing photo shoots and runway shows, she noticed there was a lack of variety of shades of makeup for brown skin. Her own personal cosmetic collection did not include products made with her eczema and acne-prone brown skin in mind. So Alicia created Range Beauty, a makeup line with skincare benefits for, as she says, the forgotten shades. She's been featured in Forbes, Teen Vogue, Allure, Essence, and Beyonce.com. And during the pandemic, Range Beauty was launched on the Target.com site, where her products regularly sell out very quickly. Wow. So we're so happy to have Alicia Scott on the show today.
And Michelle, my nephew, Nick, Nicholas Antoine, is a Princeton grad, class of 2012, and he's the co-founder and managing partner of Red Arts Capital, which was formed in 2015. So his company is a leading private equity firm focused on supply chain services, logistics, and related industries. And since its inception, Red Arts has completed mergers and acquisitions of approximately, get this, $200 million. That's a lot of dough. The firm's objective is to invest in privately owned, family owned, and multi-generational businesses with solid operating fundamentals, strong reputations, and track records of financial performance. Nick began his investment career as an equity research analyst for Princeton Global Asset Management before he moved out to Chicago and joined Ariel Investments as an equity research associate. And by the way, Nick is an accomplished musician. The kid plays a mean saxophone. And we've actually watched him play with the great saxophonist, Lou Donaldson. But obviously Nick learned quickly, you can't make any money in playing jazz.
Well, not if you want a nice car.
All right, so we're going to welcome Alicia and Nick to the show, and we're going to start with the Princeton Tiger first, all right? And so, Nick, you know, we're really interested in finding out how your interest in fundraising came about. And was there anyone in your life that you met that kind of spurred you on or pointed you in this direction?
Sure. Well, first, I just want to say thanks so much for having me on the show. It's really a pleasure and honor to be here. Fundraising for me and for my business partner and our firm really stems out of the need to be able to execute what we want to do, which is invest. We want to invest in businesses in the supply chain and logistics space, and we're interested in helping those businesses grow operationally as well. And in order to do those things, because we have deep conviction in our ability to help those businesses grow and to invest the dollars in the right way, we need to raise those dollars to then be able to do those things. So that's really where it stemmed out of. I think a couple stories for me as to where that interest came from and the ability to do so. One starts on the personal side. So my stepdad, as you know, was instrumental in introducing me to investing and finance. Mm-hmm. And when I was in college, I first started investing in the stock market when I was in third grade.
Third grade.
I'll see if I can find a picture, but there's a picture actually. It was an article in the local newspaper about me and some friends who were picking stocks in third grade.
I thought you were going to tell us that there's a picture of you on the stock exchange while you were in the third grade.
No. Not that far. But it seemed like really exciting at the time. And my stepfather, he really always encouraged me to pursue my interest, particularly as related to business. I always had an interest in entrepreneurship and building things. And when I got to college, I was really taking it seriously, and he was giving me books to read. Mm-hmm. And one year, I helped my parents think through and how to manage their 401k money and their savings through the financial crisis. And my parents came to me and they said, gee, you know, this was really helpful. Maybe you can help us on a go-forward basis. Mm-hmm. And my stepdad encouraged me to think about investing our family's money as if I were providing a professional service. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, Nick can do this. And if he's going to do it, he should do it the way that professionals do it. He should charge a fee. He should do it professionally. And so that encouragement very early on in my life really made me comfortable with understanding the fiduciary responsibilities and what it meant to steward someone else's capital. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can't do it for yourself and your family, then, you know, going and doing that with other people, I think, is also a stretch. The second part later for me was working at Ariel Investments. So connecting tigers again, the founder of Ariel, John Rogers, has been a mentor for me for many years since college. And I worked in the research department there. And then I went to work for him directly in this assistant role where it was kind of like a chief of staff role. And in that role, I got to see what fundraising looked like on a daily basis. And that was on the real professional, the big leagues style. And I saw some of the same principles that I saw that my stepfather taught me, which was, you know, how to take things seriously, how to be sincere, to also to under promise and over deliver. You never want to over promise and under deliver. And you want to be sincere in what you think you can offer. Mm. And, you know, you're looking to find people who are also interested in what you have to offer. Not everyone wants to invest money with you, but the people who do, that's the goal, is to find those people who share similar interests.
Now is Ariel located in Chicago, and is that why that you're using Chicago as your home base now, where you started Red Arts Capital at?
That's correct. Yes. So Ariel was founded in Chicago by John, and today is run by both John and Melody Hobson, who are really extraordinary entrepreneurs. And one of the fortunate things I had, in addition to working with John, was just to build relationships here in the city. And so when I started with my business partner also had relationships in the city, and it just made sense. And Chicago's been a great home for us and a really great opportunity to start a business. It's a very small town feel for a big city, so we've been fortunate.
So we would be remiss if we didn't also mention that John and Melody are Princeton graduates as well. Okay. So
yes, they are.
Yes, right. So since this is family hour, because Nick is related to Ray, and our next guest, Alicia Scott, is related to me. So Alicia, I've known you since you were born, and I know that you were always a go-getter. There's a little funny story we have about Alicia. We took her to a mall when she was about 2 years old and she wanted a cookie. So she walked up to someone and took it out of their hand and said, thank you. And she was so cute. Everybody was like, oh.
Well, yeah, she said thank you. So, I mean, it had to be cute.
But anyway,
if
Alicia,
you want
I know that.
I want, I go for it.
Hey, always a go-getter. That's what I'm saying. So I know when you were growing up, you were always interested in fashion and fashion design. And so I'm wondering what inspired you to make the transition from clothing to makeup?
Yes, I, from a very young age, loved fashion. I always said I couldn't wait till the day arrived where I was walking down the street and I saw someone wearing something that I designed. And so post-graduation, I moved to New York. I took any fashion job that would have me. I was an intern, a designer's assistant, a New York Fashion Week assistant, and worked my way up to be an account executive at a fashion sales and PR showroom eventually. But each role I was in, I would always find myself behind the scenes. I always wanted to make sure the clothing was on the models correctly. I wanted to make sure the models looked how the designer wanted them to look. Hair, makeup was done correctly. And this is where I noticed a pattern of a lot of the Black models were actually coming to set with their own makeup kits. And it took me a minute to drill down that it was only specifically Black models doing this. And I asked the model one day, I was on set and I asked her, and she spoke to me about a previous campaign she worked on where the makeup artist had her in the chair and flat out said to her, I can't do this makeup look that the designer is requesting for the show because I don't have anything in my kit for your skin tone. And they ended up sending her down the runway barefaced while everyone else had their makeup done. And yeah, and just to hear how she felt, especially when you think about New York and you think of it being such a melting pot, and you would think that they have these resources at their hands. So to hear her speak about this, to hear her use the word or the phrase that she was embarrassed about her skin tone, to feel like her skin tone was a problem, so much so that she felt she needed to now put together whatever she could find makeup wise so that she could come to sets and shows and campaigns prepared in case she received the same answer again from another makeup artist, which she had more times to count, you know, after that. And that really resonated with me because I didn't have a makeup collection. I stuck to mascara and eyeliner because I didn't have to worry about my skin tone or my skin type with those. And so sitting there and hearing this huge issue with there being a lack of deep shades available, and then on top of that, that these brands use so much filler ingredient, they use a lot of toxic ingredients that would irritate my eczema and my acne. And it just dawned on me that I needed to create a product that merged both of these worlds together. I wanted to create an inclusive shade range that also took care of your skin while you were wearing it, mainly if you also suffered from acne and eczema like I did.
Okay, so you had to start from scratch and start your brand. So take us through how you did that and how difficult was it to even get it going?
Yes. So fortunately, I was actually surrounded by a lot of entrepreneurs that I was able to lean on. But I will say my biggest resource that helped me start this journey was Google. Google became my best friend. I was on Google, I don't even know how many times a day, you typing in what it was I needed. How do you start a cosmetics brand? What things do you need in order to have a business legally? What do I need to do? Blah, blah, blah. So I just searched for whatever came to mind. I created my own checklist style to say, okay, this is what I need in order to operate a business legally. Here's what I need in order to actually create the makeup itself. So the base, the toner, et cetera. Here's what I need to do because I don't want to go the lab route and try to sit there back and forth because I don't have the budget for that. I need to go to a manufacturer who already has a lab on site and can do this for me. And so I just went through all of these questions myself. And then the last question was actually, I knew that I couldn't do it in New York. I was already, you know, down to my last cent to living the New York lifestyle. You know, not my pay was not really matching my lifestyle in New York. And so I really believed in this brand that I wanted to create. And so I knew working the role that I was in fashion, especially in New York, is very demanding. I barely had any time to myself. So making sure that I found somewhere where I had flexible hours and making sure I found somewhere where I could have enough money to cover my bills and then also cover anything needed for Range Beauty. And so I actually Googled top place for entrepreneurs to move to start a business. And out of the list that came up, one list had that Atlanta was the number one place for Black women to start businesses. And so I spent about 3 months and saved up as much as I could and just packed up and moved to Atlanta to start the journey of building the brand.
That's an exciting story. So that takes us back to Nick, because we're going to ask him some questions about finding new businesses. So Ray, over to you.
Right. So Nick, tell me about Red Arch Capital. And when you're targeting different companies and corporations, do you also target minority companies as you're seeking out future areas of investment? And if a Black-owned company is looking for a place to invest, how would they solicit themselves to you?
Sure. So our focus is in investing in small and medium-sized businesses that provide services in the supply chain space. What that means, or the way we define it, can be categorized into six buckets. So things like warehousing and distribution, things like specialty trucking or transportation, over-the-road transportation, railroad and related services to the rail, services related to airports and fixed-based operations, or could be concessions at airports. Then in the auto space, particularly auto aftermarket, meaning after the car has been manufactured and you're replacing parts. And then lastly, technology and general business services. And so our plan and our goal and in making investments is oftentimes you find a founder or founding family that started a business and has grown it to a very successful level. But then they need help continue to grow that business, or sometimes their children don't want to run the business and they want to retire, or sometimes, unfortunately, there are things where there's an estate challenge and now suddenly there needs to be a new owner. So we come in oftentimes in those instances where there's a transition that is needed or wanted for the business. And the goal is to grow that business, continue to grow that business, and be a steward for the family and the brands they've built, the employees, et cetera. How we target them is really focused on the type of service they provide. So of course, we're very interested in supporting Black entrepreneurship. Since we're a Black owned investment firm, we're interested in supporting diversity of all kinds. So not just people of color, but women as well. But that is not our go-to-market. Our go-to-market is if you have a specialty trucking business or a freight brokerage business or a warehousing company or a port logistics business, and you're looking for help growing that business or you're looking to sell your company, call us. Now, to the extent that you are a person of color, Black or brown or just a good person needs some help, give us a call. I'll also add too that we do consider in approaching helping those businesses grow, we do want to approach even management, or if there's a new CEO that's needed or a new executive that's needed at the business, we do approach recruiting from a diverse perspective. And our reason, not only is it the right thing to do, but also diversity of thought, diversity of experience, an important part of making a business competitive. And if you look at our sector, but unfortunately lots of sectors in the industry, in this economy rather, more times than not, it's a very diverse, a lacking of diverse management teams. Mm-hmm. It's and we feel that when you have people from different backgrounds who look different than you, they're going to add a different perspective based upon their experiences and their cultures and their ways of thinking that will help the business grow in a way that others and the other competitors might not. And so we think not only is it the right thing to do ethically, morally, but it's also the right thing to do because it's good business.
So I have one quick question. I would imagine that you guys are following the infrastructure bill in Congress right now very carefully, because within a matter of weeks, there could be a tremendous amount of money flowing into infrastructure all over this country, Nick.
Yeah, so we do follow and read the news and stay in touch with our representatives to learn where things might be headed and what opportunities or threats might be presented to us. I would say in addition to the future growth opportunities, it's also how do you get the materials to where they need to be in the country? And what does that mean for employment? And you see that all the time. We invest in spaces that I think the country doesn't think of as very sexy or exciting, but are incredibly important to sustaining our economy. I think we've seen that during COVID, when no one could go out, but you still need stuff to get to your door or get to your business. Our businesses and our industries were considered essential service. And so they were up and running the whole time and were really relied upon. And I think a lot of people started to see things a little bit differently, which was helpful for us as investors. in a whole host of ways. So yes, we stay on top of things like the infrastructure spending and discussions in our government about how to help build our country.
Fascinating, Michelle.
So Alicia, Nick's not in the same business you are, but I know the whole issue about supply chain became extremely important to you during COVID because you actually faced the intersection of two types of events. We had the COVID pandemic and the lockdown, and we also had the support for Black Lives Movement where everybody was trying to put their money behind Black entrepreneurs and Black businesses. And so tell us a little bit about how those two events intersected for you and what kinds of problems you had with your supply chain.
Yes, of course. So ahead of the pandemic, we were actually in a program called Target Takeoff Beauty. And so that was basically preparing us to enter retail with Target. That wrapped up, I believe, March or April, and they announced us being in the program and gained a lot of exposure. Right off, that was basically the peak of the pandemic. And we were already buckling down and said, okay, let's not go too deep in our inventory because we did not know where the economy was going to go at that point. We didn't know what online shopping was really going to look like, even though when it comes to beauty, makeup, skincare, it's typically recession, and now we know pandemic proof. But we wanted to just be careful with, let's keep as much as we can in our accounts because we don't know which way this is going to go. But with the pandemic, we saw that e-commerce reigned supreme and everyone was shopping for everything on .com and our website blew up. And on top of that, it was the spotlight on Black Lives Matter and the movement and police brutality and what are ways that we can support the Black community. A major way, let's buy Black owned. And the exposure that we received within 1 to 2 months completely surpassed the exposure we had received through the past 2 years. And it happened very quickly. We were at the top of a lot of lists. We were in publications that you typically pay to be in. We had a lot of amazing shout outs, Beyonce.com, Vogue, Gabrielle Union, just exposure we were not expecting, and nor was our inventory ready. So we went through 4 months of inventory within 3 weeks. And at the same time, our manufacturer actually decided to pivot and place cosmetics on the back burner and focus on producing hand sanitizer. And so while we're, you know, peak exposure and everyone's rushing to our store and everybody's saying, oh, Black owned doesn't mean it's only for Black people. Amazing. Yes, we want to give this a try. All those things, right? So at that time that was happening, we're trying to work with our manufacturer to get us some inventory. And it was a huge lesson for me because it was my first time running into do not have all of your eggs in one basket. And unfortunately, we weren't able to now shift to another manufacturer. You know, there was a lot of pivoting going across a lot of supply chains. A lot of people were trying to figure out how they could add to hand sanitizer, how they could produce masks, a lot of inventory. A lot of people were already trying to get their inventory replenished, so manufacturers were backed up. So it was a difficult time for us to even try to find a backup manufacturer. And so we really had to, we waited out. We waited about 3 weeks on top of our original lead time, which is about 6 weeks for us to get our inventory back up. And it was very difficult. You'd never want to be in a place where you have all eyes on your store and you don't have the inventory to support it because that is lost money. And that's also a poor customer experience. And then as you all know, on top of that, we were experiencing issues with USPS. And so there was a lot of breakdown happening at a time when you wanted all of your pieces to be working very smoothly together. And so it was a difficult time. But in the end, we were able to come through. It was our best year yet. It was my first six-figure plus year. It was my first full-time year. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Keep your father out of your budgeting.
Yes. It was my first time. I had just left my 9-to-5 in December of 2019 to take on Range full time. So there was a lot going on. It was our first time entering a retail partner. So last year was trying, but still very successful, and I would go through it all again, surprisingly. So
as you mentioned, over the past 4 months or a year or so, you've been mentioned in Forbes magazine twice. You've been mentioned in Essence and Teen Vogue and Allure and a lot of magazines, and often in the category of top 10 beauty products to watch. So I'm wondering, I'm sure the visibility has been great for you, but also challenging. And how have you thought about growing your business in response to the demand?
Right. So my biggest issue with growing, especially with makeup, you have to be very careful because it's easy to fall behind, especially when you're thinking of, you know, the big cosmetic brands. They have the capital at hand. They have the resources to push out products constantly. Sometimes, obviously, there might be a 1 to 2 year lead time, but they're still able to come out with new products and basically keep up with the trends. As an indie brand, my hugest issue with scaling was capital. And I didn't really know how investment worked at the time. My only insight at the time was actually Shark Tank. And so when it came to me really, okay, I bootstrap this as far as I can. How do I make sure I'm actually scaling and not becoming stagnant? And so I started speaking to a lot of investors who loved what I was doing. They loved that, it's hybrid makeup and skincare. They love that it's inclusive, the price range, everything. But most of these firms were white male dominated. And so we would get on the call and I would try to explain the need for it. And it's just like, oh, okay, whatever. So what's your revenue? What's your acquisition cost? And I didn't have enough data yet to really support what our mission was. And so I got a lot of no's, which caused me to actually started thinking about, okay, how else can I receive money? And that's when I started researching about grants and pitch competitions. And then I drilled in even more and found that they had ones that were specifically created for minority owned and then specifically created for Black women owned businesses. And so across the span, I would say of 2019 to 2020, I competed in about 8 different pitch competitions and racked up $265,000 with $200,000. Thank you. With $65,000 of that being just grants, and then the $200,000 coming at the end of last year as my first investment. And it brought a lot of attention to me being able to speak to the fact that Black women only receive less than 1% of venture investments. And we're out here creating these powerhouses, and we're out here really, you know, providing huge solutions to huge problems. But when they see who is behind the brand, it's a whole different conversation. And last year definitely shined a light on the need to invest more in Black-owned and Black women-owned businesses and just give us the room and the opportunity to grow, just like the guys that are coming in with, you know, 3 notes on paper and they're receiving $1.5 million in investments. And so last year was definitely a turning point. I was able to speak to a lot more diverse firms, which was really, really nice to see. And hopefully this year we're able to actually close our first round. That's the goal for the end of this year.
Michelle, it sounds like we have to get your niece and my nephew together.
It seems like they might be able to share some information.
Yeah.
Even though they're not, you know, even though their spheres of influence aren't exactly the same.
Right.
Knowledge is always helpful when it's shared. So, Nick, what do you think about all of that?
One, congratulations. It sounds like you've built an incredible business, and this is just the beginning. So, congratulations. I was noodling on a couple of folks and people that wondering if we already know in common, but we can talk offline after the podcast. But okay. I would be happy to be helpful if there's any way I can do so.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
You know, before we go, we kind of listened to Alicia about what's on the horizon for her. Nick, where do you see Red Arts Capital going in the next year or two?
We are continuing to invest and stick to our knitting. One of the things I learned from John was focus is extraordinarily important, and remaining focused over a long period of time. You know, when I joined, I think they were just in their 30-year anniversary. And, you know, he'd started the company when he was 24, and they were, you know, at the time they were $15 billion under management. You know, it took a long time, but that focus and that persistence was extraordinarily helpful to them. And so, not trying to reinvent the wheel here, just take what I've learned from folks who are better than I and try to apply them in our sphere. And so that's what we're looking to do, is just continue to build our brand as hopefully as experts in our space. If you have a business that needs help or is looking to grow, or kids don't want to run the business anymore, please think of giving us a call. And you know, and then try to be helpful to other people in our community along the way.
So it's always amazing to me how quickly our 30 minutes goes.
Oh, yeah.
But I want to take this moment to thank the both of you. You're the youngest folks we've had on the show. And we're trying to make sure that...
We're trying to build our brand.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Absolutely right. And we're also trying to make sure that our Black communities realize that we have talented young people
absolutely.
In our communities, and that you don't have to be 60 in order to have something important to say or to know what mm-hmm. you're talking about. So I do want to thank you both so much for coming on the show and sharing your experiences with us. And I do hope that you all will be able to stay in contact with each other afterwards, and let's bring all Black people forward and make it possible for us to live in a world that we create that reflects us and that is successful. Mm-hmm. So thank you so, so very much for joining us today.
Nick, Alicia, thank you so much for your time, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So as our listeners know, I already had my turn on the other side of the mic.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
I'm happy to say that next show, my wonderful co-host Ray Smalls is going to take his turn on the other side of the mic. Ray and a friend of his named Mark Robinson have co-authored a book called Place of Privilege, Young Black and in an Unexpected Place of Privilege, which details their experiences at Dalton School in New York, which is a private school in Upper Manhattan. So we're looking forward to that, where Ray gets to be interviewed as opposed to doing the interview. So that's up next.
We're really looking forward to it.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, visit our website, NubianTigersPodcast.com. In addition to the podcast, we also post a resource page for each subject to provide additional information to our listeners. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @NubianTigers, written as one word. We're also on YouTube on the Nubian Tigers podcast channel. Our podcast is hosted by Anchor FM, but if you have a favorite podcast app, we're probably on it. Just look for Nubian Tigers Talk. Looking forward to sharing some knowledge with you next time.
Wake up, wake up, wake up.